Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. Today, we are very pleased to have joining us Ellen Pinsky, whose book, Death and Fallibility in the Psychoanalytic Encounter, Mortal Gifts, will be our topic of conversation. I want to introduce Dr. Pinsky. I believe you're Dr. Pinsky, is that correct?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, so not everyone's a doctor in the field, but I just wanted to make sure. Dr. Pinsky has published articles and reviews in Psychoanalytic Quarterly, JAPA, American Imago, Salmagundi, and the Three Penny Review. I will say this about her book. She's clearly a writer, a terrific writer, so I'm not surprised that she has publications inside and outside of the field. She's also on the faculty of the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, where she was awarded the Deutsch Prize for Writing, and she is maintains a private practice as well in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So without further ado, welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, Dr. Pinsky. And my name is Tracy Morgan. I forgot to say, this is Tracy Morgan, your steadfast host. So welcome again, Dr. Pinsky.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. I want to ask you if you can just begin to give us in broad strokes or minute strokes, actually, what was it that prompted you or aroused a desire in you to begin to work on and to create this book?
Well, I would say a single event, though, of course, complicated beyond that, which was the sudden death of the therapist that I had been working with for over 4 years, 4.5 years. This was in 1994. And at the time, I was very engaged in the treatment with him. It was a 2 and 3 times a week treatment. And I was also in graduate school at that time in the process of changing my profession. And he died very unexpectedly. So I would say that that event was really, you know, what triggered my need to think about certain things and then go on to write about it.
Well, this is a book that combines two topics, right? Which is what fascinated me, is the way in which you position the unique experience of the analyst's death side by side with the analyst's violation, I guess you could say, of the frame or the murder of the analysis. So we have both of these topics, and I was very surprised at the many different ways that you much rather have your analyst die than violate the frame, perhaps, I was thinking as I...
Well, I think that's one of the things I was trying to think through, was what was the difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what, can you talk to us about the difference? I mean, how would you describe this difference?
Well, I think that the idea that came to took possession of me was the idea of the analyst's vulnerability, that the analyst is a human being, and that human beings, they are fallible, they can make mistakes, and they can also, they're vulnerable, they can die, they can get sick, they can die. And I start over time, I thought about this in the terms of the sequence of maybe how I elaborated these ideas. Mm-hmm. I was a graduate student at the time, and I was incredibly taken, already very immersed, kind of in love with psychoanalysis, and very immersed in reading the psychoanalytic literature. Mm-hmm. And this person, I was very engaged with him. I had gone back to school to get a clinical degree. It's maybe relevant to all of this also in terms of who I am and what this book comes out of, is that I was, my first profession, I was a teacher for 25 years. I was a middle school, junior high school English teacher for 25 years. And at a certain point made a decision to, and what I did in the classroom, how I was with those children in the classroom, I do think of as sort of a natural step that I took to also be thinking about whether I might like to do clinical work. Mm-hmm. So then I did go back to school and to see what it would be to get a clinical degree. And early on in graduate school, I think it was in my second year in graduate school, this person who I had been working with suddenly died. So I ended up actually writing my doctoral dissertation on this subject. So this book, these essays, really the sort of the structure of the argument in the book, it's very related to what the doctoral dissertation contained. Mm-hmm. But all of the essays were reworked, you know, rewritten. Things were changed over time. And in the course of that, I went on to psychoanalytic training and became an analyst. So I'm not sure I've answered the question yet, but
it does not read like a dissertation. I mean,
let me tell you that one of the things that I was very fortunate in was that I was not in a traditional PhD program. I went to, used to be called, it's now William James College, I believe. It used to be called Massachusetts School of Professional Psychology. Mm-hmm. So my degree is a PsyD degree, a mm-hmm. Doctor of Psychology. But one of the best things for me about that program, I didn't think about it when I began, but in the end, it's certainly true, was that I was required to write a dissertation. I believe they called it a doctoral project, but it didn't have to be a standard kind of, I had a lot of freedom mm-hmm. in what I did. I didn't have to do a numbers dissertation. I didn't have to do anything that fit a certain kind of category that might mm-hmm. be more standard. So I was freed up in that sense to just start to write. So, I mean, this book, this collection of essays is very different from what the doctoral dissertation was. It's both similar to, but it's also quite transformed. But the doctoral dissertation was finished in 1998. Mm-hmm. And then over the years, I rewrote the essays, wrote new things, you know, but it's related to that original project. And the very first thing I looked into when I, after this person died, after this man died, was I went to the literature on the illness and death of the therapist, of the analyst.
Yeah.
And I found it unbelievably lacking, kind of superficial. There wasn't a whole lot of it. And very little of it had to do with the perspective of the patient, the bereaved one. So I was very interested in that. So the first things I wrote really were about the failure of that literature. It's better, you know, people have written more over time. But that's where I went first. And then I think mixed in with that, I started to think about What were the qualities of what it was to be the person who sits in the, you know, in the analyst seat? Okay, you're a human being. It's not just that you're vulnerable, you can get sick and die. You can also make errors, and you can also, you can do wrong things or things that are harmful. And concurrent with all of this, once I then went into analytic training, which was right after I graduated from, got my degree. So part of my story, part of the story of where this book came from, was that there were, we lost in my first 10 years at BPSI in the Boston community, we lost three senior analysts to ethical misconduct. Mm-hmm. So that was all in the mix of what I was all the time thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sex and death.
Yeah.
And yet this book is in its own way a very quietly, persistently sexual book. I kept thinking, you know, if Andre Green was alive, he would be very happy to read this book, because you do place sex and the erotic and the erotic countertransference and, you know, fantasy at the heart in some ways of, I think, how you view what an analytic treatment can, what do you say? It sort of can heat, use these words, you know, there's a, like there's almost like you get the sense of the consulting room is like a cauldron, and because of
neutrality,
the desire of the patient, you know, grows, and it's then
it pulls for that. It's structured to intensify the very powerful attachment and feelings for the transference magnet, for the analyst. Mm-hmm. And I think that just inherently, it's a situation that has a lot of heat and brings with it the potential for, it brings with it dangers. Danger is also inherent. Mm-hmm. Risk is also inherent, because you have these two people alone in a room. I think I say somewhere in the book that it's a carefully controlled seduction, mm-hmm. and that, you know, the person who is responsible for, shepherding this, is just a human being, you know, is someone who, with all sorts of possibilities for getting into difficulty.
Absolutely. And as I was reading the book, I was thinking about psychoanalytic training, and the book addresses this, but you're asking questions and you're suggesting at some level that, you know, there's a moral, what is the word? The analyst is the moral safeguard. There are principles that at play that the analyst must abide by.
Right.
And you remind us that, this is an invitation to fall in love. That's what the treatment is, right? And that abstinence is alluring.
Yeah, that's a very important idea. Let me just emphasize that now that you say it. In the writing of these essays, I think I became increasingly interested in that idea. I mean, I think I said it in some version early in one of the early papers, but over time, as I, worked over and worked through this subject more and more, I became increasingly struck by that paradox that the abstinence is alluring, that it is the analyst's holding back that makes the analyst all the more magnetic and attractive, and it opens up the possibility for a tremendous depth of exchange.
Yeah. There's like two really important, they feel very important to me, questions. So I was thinking about the importance you place on neutrality and absence have gotten like a bad rap for the last 20 years.
They've also been misinterpreted in my view.
Absolutely, yeah.
They've been sort of distorted and, yeah.
Yeah, there's a straw man kind of feel to the way in which, you know, this sort of Freudian analyst, blah, 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 was, you know, went about his business. But I think that, so abstinence, as you write, protects and heats.
Right,
neutrality and abstinence, following your argument, maybe nothing analytic ever happens. So I wanted to ask you a question. I think that analysts, and I think Nathan Kravis writes about this, that, you know, we also hate psychoanalysis. It's like easy to hate it. Like, you know, the world hates it. We sometimes hate it.
We clinicians hate it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That we also hate it, and because it's difficult. It's a tough job.
Yeah.
What would you think if I were to say that the current turn in the literature toward and presumably in the clinic toward enactments and the analyst subjectivity, are these symptoms of would it be fair to say these may be symptoms of anti psychoanalytic hatred?
I'm going to give a very simple, answer. I'm not trying to be funny, but it is kind of funny. My answer would be, but this is very simple-minded, pared down. My answer would be yes. I tend to think so. I tend to think that we're always in some way, skirting or avoiding or in some way trying to manage what is both, you know, powerful, both has the possibility to help, but also is hateful, mm-hmm. painful and hateful and hard. And I guess I think that, you know, one thing I might suggest is that there is an underlying way in which, I don't think I use this word anywhere in the book, but somebody used it in talking about what she thought was underlying my argument or embedded somewhere, is that there is actually a pull that's embedded in the structure of the arrangement towards something perverse. Mm-hmm. And that one is the dyad, you know, there's always that temptation or that pull to something that is perverse.
Well, right. And that all these feelings emerge, no one is to act. We're just to continue to talk about these, you know, particularly sexual feelings and the erotic, you know, transference. And the analyst is supposed to use words and the patient is supposed to use words. And it is a form of, suffering on the road to potential freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Do you care to elaborate a little bit more? You talk about, you return us to Winnicott and the idea of retaliation, right, being the death of the analysis. So this situation, this setup can arouse retaliatory feelings in the analyst.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, you have other things to say about this in the book. Would you care to sort of give us?
Well, that I, you know, for me, you know, one of my favorite exercises across the years, and I use it in one place in one of the essays, is this notion of the time capsule. Mm-hmm. And I used to play this game with one of my very wonderful supervisors when I was a candidate. And he was also, I would say, you know, something of a Freud junkie, as, you know, I sort of am, mm-hmm. You know, that I love, especially their early papers and papers on technique. And I think he's a great writer. And so we used to play this game, the time capsule, and you are to imagine that the entire psychoanalytic literature is destroyed. It's just destroyed tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But you have time to put in a time capsule. Let's say, you know, choose your number, but let's say 10 papers from across the history of mm-hmm. psychoanalysis that you would put in this time capsule. And if somebody could dig up that time capsule 250 years from now, from what was in the time capsule they could reconstruct psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. And two of the papers that I would always have in my time capsule would be Observations on Transference Love would be one. I just think it's fundamental. And mm-hmm. I would also have Winnicott's Hate in the Countertransference, mm-hmm. because I think of those two papers. I think of Winnicott in Hate in the Countertransference, not just in that paper, but in that paper in particular. He's actually in conversation with Freud. Mm-hmm. You know, and Freud is saying in Observations on Transference Love, you know, what are we to do with this love? And what am I to do with what that evokes in me? And essentially, I do think it's a paper about the countertransference, Observations on Transference Love. But then Winnicott is saying, you know, what do I do with the hate, you know, that's evoked in me, mm-hmm. the analyst.
Absolutely. And I think I was going to ask a question about training, and I'll return to it. Yeah. It seems appropriate. I was thinking about, the analyst having to contend with the perverse feelings aroused in us as we sit and listen to patients, feelings that we, you know, might have a resistance to feeling ourselves, but the more we get in touch with those feelings, usually the better the analysis can go. You ask, what kind of caring is this, is a quote, and then you say, what will prepare the analyst for such a, quote, impossible profession?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking.
I don't know how to answer that question, by the way. I don't know how to answer that question,
I want to steer us in a little bit of a particular direction, which is that many candidates here in New York, it's sort of an open, I would consider it to be an open secret. And I imagine it's also the case that New York is not unique in this realm, that many candidates will speak, or recent graduates will speak finally about that they didn't tell the truth to their training analysts.
Say that again, the first part, they did not tell the truth?
They did not feel free to tell the truth about themselves to their training analysts, nor to tell the truth to their training supervisors, right on their, you know, control.
About what they actually did clinically?
About what they actually felt. I mean, I've been in peer supervisions with candidates and graduates alike, and listening to candidates talk about, like, particularly the erotic countertransference, and feeling like, well, I can't talk to my supervisor about this. And I'm thinking, well, so how do we prepare, given, I think that this is not an uncommon phenomena. Candidates are terrified of being judged inadequate, wrong, that their feelings are wrong, that they shouldn't have these feelings, they should be over these feelings, whatever they may be. Rather than many institutes don't think of these feelings as aroused by the patient, they think that the candidate must go back into treatment. It's a heartbreak, but it is the only protection that we have to enter into this work is to be able to feel everything and have someone to talk to about it. So do you?
Go ahead.
Any thoughts about this? Because it seems like we set ourselves up to end up having analysts graduating who are not prepared to contend with some very hard feelings like hate and sexual desire.
Right.
Because
they're
deemed as, you should be beyond that or above that. I mean, I can't tell you how many people, I'm not trained, I'm trained as a modern analyst. So it's a little bit, it's quite different. And training in the use of feelings is the centerpiece of the work.
Yeah.
So all feelings are like, bring them. But a lot of friends in other institutes were like, I can't talk to my supervisor. They'll report this and it'll all be seen as weird.
Yeah. I don't have an easy answer. Of course, there is no easy answer to that. I can think of, I do have some idea from, you know, what I've read about the history of the discipline, that kind of thing, I mean, I don't think something like that ever goes away, ever becomes a non-problem, mm-hmm. but that it perhaps was even an even greater problem years ago, when it was also standard for there to be reporting. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think about, well, two things occur to me. I think there's a wide variation, and I do think it would have to depend. I also think in some part that nobody ever tells the whole truth to anybody, you know, even if you're in a very good analysis. Mm-hmm. I think that there's always a certain amount that's withheld or held back. And that's part of what becomes interesting to think about is what is it that one is reluctant to say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I think about my own experience, I want to say, two things. In part, I was very lucky in that the people that I worked with, I had three really terrific supervisors, people to whom I don't think I told everything, but I didn't have a whole lot of hesitation to be able to tell them what, you know, feelings that I had or the stupid thing that I did. Mm-hmm. So I think I was very lucky in that way. And in the, you know, in terms of in the classroom, there was a lot of variation, but I think I had a lot of good teachers who addressed things like this, mm-hmm. questions like the one you're raising or the dilemma that you're raising. Yeah. So it was also sometimes something that could be spoken about, mm-hmm. which I think was helpful. I also think that in my particular instance, I think that one of the benefits, and I don't know if you would notice anything like this in terms of, you know, the age that a person is, but I went into this pretty late, you know, in relation to what many people do. I was in my past my mid-50s, I think it was 56 maybe, when I started analytic training. And I think that there was something about being older that meant that I was productively less inhibited in certain kinds of ways, you know, freer to speak. So I think that that was just a, you know, an advantage that I had in that area. But I also think that, you know, one of the things that I enjoy doing best is actually teaching writing. Mm-hmm. And I've taught the writing class at BPSI for candidates, and I've also taught another writing class that, you know, invites people from across the hierarchy to, you know, like a writing workshop. Anything that you want to write that's about psychoanalysis is welcome in this class. And I find that that kind of attention to what one is putting down on the page and then bringing it and sharing it, mm-hmm. actually opens up all kinds of very useful conversation about what one will risk saying, what one is hesitant to say, you know, either in writing, but there's an analogy to the talking to a supervisor or to talking to one's analyst. So I have found that in terms of a teaching, the earplug just thought, a teaching context that I think opens up thinking about what it is that one is or isn't going to risk saying. Mm-hmm. I find that a very important, for me, it's an important thing for students to be talking about their writing. You know, how do they convey, for example, you know, their own clinical work, you know, in writing, I think can then be also a way to reflect on how one is in one's own, you know, analysis. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Is that sort of coherent? Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that we're getting...
I mean, I realize I'm kind of surprised that you say that, yes and no, but that it seems that it's so prevalent, that there's so much inhibition that way.
Secret. I mean,
yeah.
I really,
yeah, I'm sure you're right.
I think it's an open secret. And I was at a conference not long ago at the from the William Allison White Institute,
right.
A mix of candidates and, you know, people out and who've been out in the field, you know, like I have for, you know, a long time. And, you know, but, you know, you could hear the whispering, like, I don't want to say this because I don't want to. And I was like, oh yeah, it's always there. The fear of being seen as pathological, you know, for speaking. And it's a heartbreak because this is the talking cure for the analytic candidate too. You know,
we
speak and our unconscious comes forth, mm-hmm. and it's not there to be condemned. Right. It's there to be, you know, to be embellished, to be understood, to be, you know, so on and so forth. So that always more can be said.
The
analyst can tolerate feeling everything. The patient, you know, and being aware of all of their feelings toward the patient and not acting on them, the patient gets better. You know, I mean, we see this happen. But you talk and you write in the book about, analytic grandiosity and charisma. And you also write about, you link together subjectivity and narcissism. So my sense through reading this book was that you have a lot of deep questions or important questions about the relational turn. You have a lot of queries, and would that be a fair statement? And would you?
Well, I'm very wary of generalizations. I guess it depends on what you mean when you use that. Those words, the relational turn. Mm-hmm. So maybe if you could say a little more about what you mean by that, you know.
Sure. I mean, I think that
I am. Well, I mean, you're right. There is. I'm sorry. I'm just thinking about, you know, your question. I know that there is a very strong thread in the book or in the essays over the course of the book, mm-hmm. that questions a certain turn in their literature that seems to me to focus with a tremendous emphasis on the analyst's experience, mm-hmm. And that there is a balance that gets tilted where I think sometimes that tendency can have the effect of reducing appropriate emphasis on the patient's experience.
When the analyst is the protagonist, you write, or when you discuss Owen surfing, and you know this
that the heroic figure or the figure that's at the center of the image, that's the analyst as surfer in one of Owen Rennick's papers. Yeah, analyst as hero, the Odysseus image. You know, for me, I'm not sure, we may be going away from your question, but we can return to it. But for me, it's telling to think about or to consider what the actual metaphors are or the images are, mm-hmm. that are articulated to capture the function or the role of the analyst. So, I mean, I fell in love at a certain point with the pick paper that I talk about with the image of the analyst walking a tightrope. Yeah. And I compare that, as I remember it, to the image of the analyst as Odysseus tied to the mast, mm-hmm. or then the Rennick one of the surfer. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's got to have some kind of reverberation or some kind of meaning that affects how we think about the discipline and what we do, mm-hmm. when the image is one that positions the analyst as the one who's the heroic figure. And I'm very much somewhere I use, I think it's a Menelaus or something. There's one image there where I say somewhere that what I like best about this, I think it may be where I use the image of Perseus and the shield. Mm-hmm. And what's more, the hero is clearly the patient.
Right.
So I incline to be, you know, I notice things like that, and to me, they have to have some kind of meaning.
Well, sure. I mean, you are very very cogent. At one point in the book, you talk about initially we have the analyst as like kind of a, you know, the telephone receiver, kind of the,
right. Know. Yeah, I spew a bunch of, right. of images. Yeah, right,
it's terrific. And then we have the sort of more Lowaldian. You know, he comes in and he introduces this idea of the mother, right,
which is right,
something.
Right.
And then you refer to Warren Poland's the technically skilled assistant. So
yeah.
Really, that's quite different. I mean, the word, also you use the word tilt in this book in a way that's so poetic. You're not talking about simply asymmetry, but you're talking about there is a tilt. What is the tilt? Which way is the analysis tilting? Poland is, there's no, I don't see a tilt there. The technical uh-huh. assistant, that language.
Yeah, yeah.
Is no, there's no tilt, and it sort of tends toward something like not quite democracy, but you know, something.
Yeah, it's very modest, actually, in comparison to the other images.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree with that. It is, yeah.
Doesn't it also sort of point to kind of like there's something a little more democratic, or something that I think of as part of the relational turn. It's sort of like, why do we, you talk about the analyst as, who do you quote, Gardner, who asks, how can we show we are human? We are either human or not. So what would you say?
Ellen, I like it because it's aphoristic, yeah.
What would you say about the desire to show that the analyst is human? What is that about?
The desire to show that the analyst is human?
If we look at the turn to the analyst subjectivity, the analyst having a subjectivity, the analyst's inner world, aspects of the analyst's emotional experience.
So are you saying that is an effort to show that the analyst is human?
I wonder.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to articulate it. Why do we have to show that the analyst is human? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Isn't the analyst human?
Right. I mean, I guess there's also, though, you know, in reading this book, I thought, you know, is the emphasis on the analyst's subjectivity, does that stand in the way of getting the transference going? Could it stalemate it? Is it just hard for us to tolerate not mattering? What would make
I find that very interesting. Is it hard for us to tolerate not mattering? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yes, it is.
That's
it
why
is.
I'm doing this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the people I was drawn to very early when I was just doing, you know, I had a dissertation advisor to whom I'll forever be grateful. In some ways, she's the source of, you know, this book in the end, that when I set out to start to write the dissertation, she said that her suggestion to me was that, I think that was probably in the spring, and in the fall, I was, you know, the following year, I was going to be completing the doctoral project. And she said, what I suggest you do for the next 3 or 4 months over the summer is just not worry about what you're going to write, but just read. Just sink into the literature and read, and let yourself find the threads or the themes that they're going to emerge as you do that. And there's a way in which the fact that it's a little bit like entering analysis and, you know, having a trust that something like that similar is going to happen, that, you know, it doesn't matter if it isn't orderly or if it feels chaotic or whatever, you're just going to let yourself sink into it.
Right.
And the what's important will take a form and will emerge. But I think that her encouragement, that I trust that process, was absolutely central for me in what enabled me to write the essays over time. But I'm not sure have we gone away from whatever your question is about the relational.
My questions don't matter. I mean, they just bring us wherever they bring us. It's fine.
Yeah.
Right. Whatever.
You know, I guess I, one of the things that's always interested me is whatever it was that was, you know, scary, and I think scary to Freud too, mm-hmm. about what it was he was articulating, you know, as he was, you know, discovering or inventing, you know, I don't care which word one uses, the psychoanalytic situation, is that, you know, things that he was calling attention to or was, you know, articulating in helping to structure the situation, and that I think he struggled with all along, you know, sort of being knocked out by the not understanding himself, having to adjust to the power that it had.
Absolutely.
I think that so much of what he articulated early on really did get distorted very much, you know, over the decades. And there's a way in which, you know, I think about me, I mean, maybe this is too tidy a way to put it or too simple-minded, but whatever it was that got the blood got taken out of it, you know, or something, and the rigidities of, you know, this in this country anyway, of those middle century years of analysis, and then whatever it is that had to get shaken up, which the relational turn is part of in the last decades of the of the century. You know, that's all embedded in the history. And I think of John Clauber, you know, sometimes someone I was drawn to very early when I was doing, I know what the connection was that in telling you about my dissertation advisor and her saying, you know, just read. Yeah. I remember that summer I discovered John Clauber and I was so struck by, you know, I was thinking about the fact that what this man had died, what was I going to, you know, make of that? I was you know, fascinated to think about it and think about what the implications were for the nature of the clinical situation. And then Clauber has a couple of essays where he writes about the neglect of, you know, how does any clinician manage, you know, working with people in this way, and then losing, you know, do quotation marks in the air, you know, ending with people loss after loss after loss after loss, and that it's not just a process of grieving for the patient who says goodbye. It was, I think, Clauber who first made me realize that there were people who thought about the task for the analyst. And I said, I mean, what could be more humanizing, you know?
You know, the work of Sandra Buechler on this?
Pardon?
You know, the work of Sandra Buechler on this? I mean, she writes so much about the impact of analysis on the analyst.
You know, I have to read it again. I have.
She's terrific. And thinking about early clinical experiences and their impact on us. And also she writes about a patient dies. And in the middle of a treatment, and she says, "Oh, you know, I can't go to the funeral because, like, who can I say I am? Like, what? How do I mourn this loss?" Your book asks a different question, which I think is so important: is what do we lose? I've had two analysts die. I've been through.
You have.
Yeah. A group analyst I was with for a zillion years, and he was quite old. And the experience of his death was really different than the experience of an individual analyst who I knew she was sick. And she, my last session with her, I came in. I mean, she was open. You know, she had, you know, she had cancer, and she was dying in her 80s. And my last session with her, which I didn't know would be my last session, she said, "I'll keep working until I can, if you can tolerate that." I said, "I can tolerate."
Yeah, but it was on the table. It was out there between you. It was talked about.
Oh yeah. No.
Yeah. Yeah. It was huge difference. Yeah.
Yeah. And I sat in her chair. I came in for a session and she really was not doing well. She was lively in the mind, but the body was, you know, failing. And so she was on the couch and she started to get up and she said, "Oh, just sit in my chair."
I mean, my goodness.
She was brilliant. And at some level knew this was likely my last session. It was Christmas.
Wow.
I was going away for 2 weeks. And when I came back, she had died. My last memory of her is us talking. She put your feet up. Put your feet up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
She was the head of the Institute of the Center for Modern
Studies. It's very poignant what you're describing.
It was beautiful. I mean, she took us with her versus my group analyst, Lou Ormont, who I adored. He had a little more grandiosity. He didn't let us know. You know, we were left hanging. And it was a group. And we're like, how could we ever see each other again to say goodbye to the members of the group?
Right, right, right. Yeah. Well, I remember very clearly what it was when my therapist died. And there's a way in which writing this book, one of the things that I think I was, among the many things I think I was doing in writing these essays over time, I also went into analytic training after he died. I don't know that I would have necessarily I'll never know, but I was not intending to go into analytic training at the time that I was working with him. Mm-hmm. But something about that death kind of catapulted me in that direction. And I sometimes think that that what I have been doing, I'm still writing about it in writing about, this subject of the analyst's mortality, mm-hmm. Is a form of retrieving him,
mm-hmm.
of finding him again. And, you know, he wasn't technically, I do those quotation marks in the air.
Mm-hmm.
He technically was not my analyst. I laugh at that because I didn't see him, 4 days a week, whatever it was. It was an analytic treatment. And I think that one of the things I like that I think I accomplish, for me, it's part of what I accomplish is that in writing these essays, I actually secure him as my analyst.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's clear.
But I didn't, I was not, I, did, I was afraid to go to his funeral. I mean, people, I was not a part of the community at the time. And someone then, the people who contacted me were quite terrific, mm-hmm. and they made it clear that I was welcome to come to the funeral. I wouldn't have gone if they hadn't made that specific mm-hmm. Invitation. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a very, I don't know what kind of word to use. It was a very moving and satisfying and important thing for me that I did go to his funeral.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Can you give more? I'm going to extend the session if you have the time, but I don't know if you do.
I have a bit of time. A little bit of time.
There's a couple of other things. I really loved this book so much. So there's a couple other things.
One of the things you liked, if I'm hearing you right, though, which I love, is that you actually liked the writing itself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The writing, I was like, oh.
It's very important to me.
And I'm like, I can't.
You know, because I do, I love the psychoanalytic literature, but I do also have trouble with a certain kind of psychoanalytic writing that's, very heavy with jargon and, sentences that are too long. And so one of my goals was to both use the language, but not get sunk in sink in the language.
Yeah.
And also to be kind of suspicious isn't exactly the right word, but to be kind of wary of assumptions about the jargon or the language.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, you didn't write a book that put me to sleep. And many are soporific. You know, it's like, okay, good night. just if I can't sleep, wake up and read some new psychoanalytic book. I'm like, oh, no. This is too difficult. I wanted to ask a couple other things, and I know Ellen wants to read something to us from the book, so we're going to leave some time for that as well, which is a real treat. But I wanted to get to, there's so much here, but anyway, I wanted to try to situate your book in relationship to the literature on boundary violations like Gabbard and Celenza, and it takes such a different tack, I think. And I wonder
how would you put that? That's very interesting to me. I think it does, but I'm very interested that you
have
what you're saying
of the word, of the term, and it's so refreshing. You were like, boundary violations? What? Like, it's at some level that's bloodless. you know,
at some level. Sorry, I missed the word. At some
bloodless, like the term boundary violations, right?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
You know, and you say something about is, you know, this is not property. Boundary
right.
violation is like, oh, you know, it's like Trumpian language. You're gonna build a wall. You're violating our boundary.
There's, yeah, I think I say it's more kinetic than that, that it doesn't, somewhere I say anyway, that it's more kinetic than that, that is an image of, yeah, as you're saying, mm-hmm. You know, something that is a line or a wall or is stationary in some way, something to be crossed, mm-hmm. but that in fact the, whatever it is that happens between the two people, it's much more kinetic than that. I think I use the language of it's more like a line of scrimmage or something like that. Then, yeah,
and I think that you.
Yeah.
But I also really like is it's as if we can't think about what does the patient lose when the analyst violates the frame. We think about what drives the analyst to do this. I think we can think of, you know, we can feel our way into that, and we've touched on some of that. But what goes on for the patient? What is lost? So the question, when you're in the midst of this transference and then the analyst becomes, acts on seductive feelings, like what is the patient lost? What is the experience for the patient? You quote that, what the woman who wrote for, I forget her name, but she was a patient who wrote about her experience, as did Muriel Dimon write about her experience.
Right.
And you know, it's excruciating because it's you say it's like it's not a boundary violation at some level. I think you say there's a rape of the treatment, not that the patient is necessarily raped, but that there's a rape of the psyche in some ways.
Like, yeah, it's a violation. Yeah, it's a violation of there's a violence implicit, something, a destructiveness, implicit. Yeah.
I think your book, I think maybe that your book could be written now. Of course, you know, we needed the books, you know, and the work by Gabbard and Scialenza, thinking about what goes on inside the analyst, to now think, well, you know, what goes on for the patient, you know, when this happens. It was almost like we couldn't look at that until we looked at what makes us, you know, when this happens, what's gone wrong?
You know, right,
what's taking
right.
place? And maybe it's a good sign that there's now space to imagine, you know, the loss for the patient.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think that one of the ways that I like to think about this collection is that I like to but I'm going to be careful because I don't want to give myself too much credit or anything, but that I think of these as not as papers, but as essays,
mm-hmm.
and that they are, they're more personal in a certain kind of way, even when they don't speak directly to, you know, to my experience that openly or that fully. That I like to think that what is conveyed is related to this area exactly of the patient's experience mm-hmm. of this loss. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my, somebody pointed out, and I was very pleased, you know, when she did in a review of the book that I saw recently, you know, that it begins with, that it has a shape, you know, the series of essays, how it starts and how it ends. Maybe this is a good moment to move toward the epilogue, which she points out is that something like that, you know, that I introduce early the fact of my own experience, which was that this person died.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then immediately the questions, you know, who had I lost? What had I lost? And also, very importantly, what had I been given? Was the other question.
Yeah.
That is the idea of the mortal gift, and that only an imperfect person, only a human person, who is by definition, because human, an imperfect being, that only an imperfect being can give that gift.
Absolutely. I mean,
and then she said, but what she said was that, you know, something along the lines of that in reading the essays and then getting to the epilogue, mm-hmm. that there was a way in which the epilogue sort of finished it, that it's sort of that all of the very beginning where I talk about the my own personal experience of mm-hmm. the loss, and then the epilogue, which is the only really personal part of directly personal mm-hmm. Part of the book, that it was all structured to fit together. And I thought, great, that's exactly what I aimed. This is exactly what I wanted, even though I wasn't thinking about it in a stepwise way.
It absolutely. I mean, it's a wonderful example of cycle, you know, within the field of auto, you know, what's known in the academy as auto theory, you know, that there's autobiography that sort of prompts a reworking, a theoretical or philosophical rethinking. So I guess, you know, oh, I have so many more questions, but we should not go too much over.
Yeah.
So if you are ready, and you have the epilogue in front of you, do you want to tell us what it is that, what you're thinking in reading this to us? What is it that you're, what makes you want to read this to us?
One thing is that, in the dissertation that I wrote, that I finished in 1998, this collection of essays is both similar to that dissertation in its overall movement. Mm-hmm. But each of the essays, a couple of the essays are completely different. They weren't written at that time. And each essay that was in the original dissertation is quite changed. Mm-hmm. But the epilogue is not exactly the same, but the epilogue was in the dissertation, and it comes very close to this form that it's in the book. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason. Mm-hmm. So something about it, I guess, is very meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. And it also... It brings him back to life for me. You know, I don't read this daily, but I pick this up every, month or two, and I read the epilogue. There's something about it that brings him back in touch with me, in a way that I like.
And it also shows us how to play with fire and
how to play with
fire, something that is often avoided. It's a beautiful example, I think, as the listeners will soon hear, of how Ellen's analyst works with her strong desire for something more and his incapacity to satisfy.
He was going to say no. Also, I don't actually remember, I don't have 100% recall of the epilogue. It may be in the text, but I'm not sure. But I'll say it just in case it isn't, that one of the things that was true of my work with him was that I used to say to him, regularly, not daily, but regularly enough, I would find myself saying, particularly toward the end of an especially powerful hour, I would find myself saying to him, I'm so afraid I'm going to lose you before I'm ready. Mm-hmm. So there's something about that maybe illuminates a little bit, how meaningful this is for me. So shall I just read it?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. It begins with, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay, it begins with a few sentences from Pablo Neruda's Childhood and Poetry. So it begins with that. I'll read that, and then I'll go on to read the text. So this is Pablo Neruda from Childhood and Poetry. I have been a lucky man. To feel the intimacy of brothers is a marvelous thing in life. To feel the love of people whom we love is a fire that feeds our life. But to feel the affection that comes from those whom we do not know, from those unknown to us, who are watching over our sleep and solitude, over our dangers and our weaknesses, that is something still greater and more beautiful, because it widens out the boundaries of our being and unites all living things. So this is the epilogue itself. When my therapist, Joseph Nemitz, suddenly died, I had been working with him in an intensive psychotherapy 2 and 3 times a week for more than 4 years. Nemitz's professional conduct, in retrospect, serves as an implicit critique of the inadequate professional literature regarding the central matter of the therapist's mortality in both primary senses. I had asked several weeks earlier if we could talk about my beginning analysis. Nemitz was surprised by my request, and I by his surprise. I thought I had made many less than subtle hints about analysis. I told him I thought I had been reasonably clear. He replied that he had not understood me. Possibly both of us were right. I came to wonder later whether I had in fact been quite clear, but that his usual capacity to hear me had in this particular matter broken down. Did he wish not to hear me? I've wondered whether his deafness to my hints came from his intuitive understanding that if I were to ask, he would have to say no, the answer he'd be compelled, as I now understand it, to give. With the refusal, I would, if I wanted analysis enough, move to another therapist. I believe that he cared very much about me, enjoyed his work with me, and preferred that I not leave him. He didn't answer me right away. He told me that because of his age, he was 71, he was cautious about beginning new analyses. When I asked if our 4 years of work together made no difference, he answered that of course it did, and that he would need some time to think about it. Over the next 10 days, I argued my case, growing more excited and hopeful as the days passed, and he did not refuse. Several minutes into our 5th meeting, after I had first asked to begin analysis, I was speaking with an animation every minute moving closer to pleased assumption. I would have my wish. I remember that he lifted his hand lightly, several inches off his knee, in a gesture that stopped me dead, a woe to a racing horse. The very long silence lasted perhaps 5 seconds, and then he spoke quietly. "There's more than one person in this room to be considered," he said. I was speechless. At that moment and in that pause, I caught a clear glimpse of him, perhaps for the first time in 10 days. So hard had I been working to obliterate him in order to have what I wanted. I saw something then about what he might feel, what he might wish, and what this decision might mean for him. I was able then to say, calmly and with tremendous sadness, "This must be hard for you, too." He nodded very slightly and said, "In many ways." Although he didn't give me his answer until the next time we met, I knew then what he would likely say and began to prepare myself for it. Sometimes I think I'd really known the answer from the beginning, maybe even before he did, and my wish not to hear what I already knew explained my impetuous rush to fill with words any space for an honest exchange with him. My unconscious hope was to keep both of us from deeper reflection, but he didn't give up that responsibility. Near the start of our next meeting, he said that given the nature of my own losses and the power of analysis, and given the good possibility that he might die before the work was done, analysis with him was not a good idea. He said that if I wanted analysis, he'd help me arrange it. I knew that given his love for the work, and especially for that work from behind the couch, his decision was not easy. But I also knew in a hazy way that it was his commitment to the work and to me that guided his decision. I asked him if he'd ever changed his mind about anything, and he replied quickly and very gently, "I once decided not to be a cowboy." As was often true in my time with this man, my laughter was part of the power of the moment. Few people have ever looked less like a cowboy. My tears and rage followed. But I didn't fully understand his words for a long time. Many months after his death, I did understand that Dr. Nemitz was telling me far more than, "No, I can't be your analyst." He was telling me that however much he might wish to give me what I wanted, he couldn't change his mind because any other decision by his lights would be wild and incautious. His refusal was dictated by his understanding of and respect for the power of the analytic process, for his own human limitations, and for me. With that decision, I think he looked squarely at the ending of his life work and of his life. At some point, I also understood his remark, "I once decided not to be a cowboy." I understood it as a rejection of the charismatic style of certain analysts. I use the word charismatic here in the pejorative sense. Nemitz had the capacity to bear the responsibility of no, and at the moment he spoke, it was to remind me that there are always two individual mortal people in the consulting room. And in that quiet reminder is located the most essential principle guarding the patient's safety. A few weeks later, on a Wednesday in mid-May, the hour came to a close. I remained angry at him. He was going away for the weekend to a conference in Philadelphia. He often ended an hour with something intended to leave me thinking. This time it was a question. His last words to me were, "What have I done to make you think I don't understand how disappointed you are?" I paused and said, "I'll think about it, and I'll let you know Monday morning." I stood up and left him with my usual tagline when he went away to meetings: "Have a good time, learn something, and cross the street very carefully." He collapsed without warning on Sunday in the airport in Philadelphia, and he died 6 days later, apparently never regaining consciousness.
Well, thank you for reading that. It's quite powerful.
Oh, there it is. Yeah.
Yeah, there it is.
So I wrote that, actually. I wrote a version of that pretty close to what it is there back in 1997, 98, when I was working on my dissertation. So the fact that it was, you know, it was pretty much, it was formed then. I mean, it was very powerful then, and it remains very powerful. And I very much like that it ended up that when I put this collection together, there it was. Still.
So if we were to take this book and just take the epilogue and put it in a time capsule and take it out of the time,
interesting.
Lost, we could take out the epilogue and perhaps in many respects reconstruct the book. So
that's good. I like that.
Yeah. There you go. So I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
I hope that you write another book and get more of your writing out there. And when you do, just let us know your book and psychoanalysis so we can talk some more.
Good. I hope we meet sometime.
Exactly. I'll look for you. I don't know where I'm going to be in the future at some conference, but I always like to find the authors that I've had the chance to spend time with and spend time with their work and spend time with them.
Yeah.
So,
thank you very much, Tracy.
Yeah, I'm glad you could join us. And to the listeners out there, thank you for listening as always. Always happy to provide you with the latest and the greatest of psychoanalytic publications. The next book that I will be doing will be Elizabeth Danto's book on Anna Freud and Tiffany Burlingham. And that should be terrific. I don't know when I'll be doing that, but in the next couple of months. So stay tuned and listen in. And I am your devoted host at New Books in Psychoanalysis, signing off for now.